Hello, this is Julianne Good, and welcome to Psych 101. We are here to make psychology more understandable, interesting, enlightening, and hopefully give you some tips for making your life and your friends and family's lives a little bit easier. Tonight, I am going into the first of hopefully two shows for the month on domestic violence awareness. This is one of the themes that I think is really important to get more information about, start talking about as a society, and start bring a little light to the subject, because this is one of those subjects that's a little bit taboo because we know it's happening or it has happened to people that we know. And it can be really disturbing, and you don't know what to do about it, and you feel sorry for the victim. You want to get him or her out of the situation, and sometimes they're not ready to go. And as a former domestic violence survivor in my childhood, this is one of the things I really want to have people educated about, because if you have been victimized, you can go and get help and you can make your life better. It's a process, but it is well worth it. Tonight, my guest is Kavita Deo, and she is from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. And hopefully Dr. Clive Kennedy will be joining us also. Kavita, hi, how are you?
Good, how are you, Julianne?
Wonderful, thank you. We tried doing this before, and I thank you so much for coming back on again and making this happen. So can you tell the audience a little bit about your background?
I am currently a fourth-year clinical forensic psychology student. I'm completing my pre-doctoral internship at Alafia Mental Health, and I will graduate in November of this year with my doctorate.
Oh, congratulations. It's a long haul, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, how did you get interested in domestic violence as a subject?
It just slowly started to happen. I wanted to complete my dissertation with domestic violence, and that was about 3 years ago, so it kind of just took off from there. And my interest in this field is to work with victims of trauma, and a lot of our victims have experienced domestic violence of some sort.
Did you find during your research that a lot of people that you were working with, the violence started in their childhoods?
Yes.
And so did you find that it was kind of a pattern that they just found that this was kind of a normal thing to go through, that they would just have to endure for the rest of their lives?
For some people, yes. It was. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the social learning behavior theory, where what we observe is what we learn. And sometimes if we're growing up in an environment where there is domestic violence, it comes to become the norm for children, so they expect that this is what a relationship may look like, and this is how they may feel loved, is if they are physically or emotionally abused by someone who's going to love them.
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty common theme, that, you know, that's the way that they learn love.
Right,
yeah. Now, we're going to talk specifically tonight about intimate partner violence. Can you explain to the audience what that is?
Absolutely. Intimate partner violence can be defined as any behavior that causes physical, psychological, or sexual harm. It includes physical aggression, that includes acts of slapping, hitting, biting, kicking, beating, stabbing, or shooting. Psychological abuse can include intimidation or belittling, and then any forced sexual activity or intercourse, as well as controlling behaviors, including isolation from friends and family, and restricting partners' access to outside information or assistance from others.
So that's a pretty wide-ranging set of behaviors.
Absolutely.
So in your view, what would be the most prominent of those set of behaviors that you've seen during your research?
Actually, it's a little bit across the board. I think the one that is most underreported and acknowledged would be the psychological abuse. People may not understand that name-calling and belittling and things like that can actually harm us emotionally. And eventually, over a period of time, can deplete our self-esteem and our self-worth. And to remain in that can eventually be even worse than physical abuse, because physical abuse wounds can heal, whereas emotional health will take longer to overcome.
Exactly. And it's more sedate. I mean, it's words. A lot of people are like, okay, so he calls me this and he calls me that, or she, or, you know, whatever the case may be, but they really love me underneath it all, even though it's all that name calling. And that, you're right. I mean, that can build up as much as any kind of physical abuse or sexual abuse. So that can be just as harming to the brain, to your self-esteem. I agree. We are going to have, we're going to have Dr. Clive Kennedy join us. Dr. Kennedy. Hello, Dr. Kennedy.
Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, how are you doing?
Wonderful. Hi.
Good.
Can you?
Using my landline phone.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you. Yes, we had a little bit of trouble the last time, and I appreciate that you're back on, too. So, yeah. So can you tell the audience a little bit about your background also?
Yes. And I'm a psychologist for the last 31 years, and I have been on the Superior Court of California panel of experts since 1985. So I actually have evaluated couples who are going through divorce. I've also evaluated individuals who have been tried and convicted of domestic violence cases. And so over the last 30 years, I've developed my own impressions of domestic violence and how it affects especially the African-American community. So hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about some of those things tonight.
Most definitely. Thank you again for joining me. And Convita, and you know Dr. Kennedy from the Chicago School of Professional Psychology, correct?
Correct. Dr. Kennedy was the chair to my dissertation, my advisor, and my supervisor for my advanced practicum placement.
So you saw each other a lot.
Yes.
Yes.
and yeah, actually, I forgot about that. I'm also an associate professor over at the Chicago School in the clinical forensic program.
Yes, so thank you.
Well, and I'll be teaching interpartner violence this summer. So that'll be coming up. And before we get off, I'll tell you a little bit about a couple of upcoming panels that will be discussing domestic violence here in town.
That would be important. Now, is that just for the school, or is that open to the general public also?
That's open to the general public. That's going to be at our Westwood campus.
Wonderful. Okay. So Kavita and I were discussing different forms of abuse, and she was mentioning that the psychological abuse seems to be the most prevalent within relationships that she had seen within her research.
I think that is true because, we now know that interpartner violence is much more prevalent than at one time we thought. When we think about battering, for example, you have those individuals, that set of individuals who are capable of doing such major medical damage to another person. But the verbal abuse is much more widespread and, of course, can escalate to more serious forms of physical violence, but it certainly is more pervasive.
Now, if a person is in a situation where they're being psychologically abused, sometimes they're into these relationships for years and they just don't realize it anymore. They're so used to being called names and belittled. How can they start breaking out of that cycle and realizing that what they're going through is abuse and it's not healthy for themselves or the relationship?
Well, you know, and I think, Kavita, you talk with some people as part of your dissertation, but I know for me, I really look at where, you know, drawing a line in the sand. If someone is calling you names, if they are putting you down routinely for their own benefit, if they're denying you access to anything, whether it's finances, sexuality, or food, or anything that they are trying to exercise their power and control and domination over you, following up, following you, stalking you, sending out emails with the unwanted emails, anything that consistently is something you do not want to happen, then you may be in a DV relationship. And so, yeah, I think that it's very important for us to be self-aware and recognize that if you feel bad whenever you talk to this other person, then that probably there's something wrong there, and it needs to be explored. And having friends that will tell you, you know, this, how are you? Why are you putting up with this person? Why are you still there? I can't believe what he said to you. If any of those things are happening or in your world space, then it's time for you to really ask yourself, are you in a domestic violence relationship?
Right. Listen to your family and friends because they're trying to protect you. They love and care about you, and they want to see the best for you, you know. And sometimes, you know, love is blind, and we want to see the best in the person, but if they're sitting there and being abusive, and it, you know, it needs to end. So, Kavita, can you tell us about the population that you worked with for your dissertation?
I primarily worked with low SES and poverty victims of intimate partner violence. Majority of my participants were of African-American or Hispanic descent. And some of them were part of a treatment program for substance abuse, and others were part of a domestic violence shelter.
Did you find that that was pretty common, that that the women that you were working with had substance abuse problems also, to kind of maybe numb themselves out or as a coping mechanism for being abused?
I do believe that substance abuse can be an outlet to deal and manage with trauma for both men and women, not just women alone.
And did you find that that was pretty common with the population you were working with?
I didn't screen my women population for substance abuse. And then the men that I did screen, they were already in a substance abuse treatment facility.
Okay. Okay, can you talk a little bit about working with males? Because I think there's probably still the general myth that within a domestic violence situation, it's a male versus a female. And as we know, it's, you know, it's men and men, women and women, and women against men. I mean, it comes in all forms. So can you talk a little bit about the men that you were working with?
I believe society plays a lot into it, and especially in patriarchal societies, it's considered unacceptable for men to fall victim to intimate partner violence. And this can make it difficult for men to recognize that they can be victims. Society and culture plays a significant part when we're looking at gender roles, and men can be held to a different standard when compared to women. So men tend to be held at a higher rank economically, politically, and socially. And then there's other issues that play into it, such as cultural norms, gender roles, socioeconomic status, level of education, religious barriers, and then in some cultures, allowing men to use violence against women. So when these ideals are challenged, it's hard to accept that a man can be a victim of intimate partner violence.
Yeah, and the resources for men who are victimized are so small in the state of California, at least when I was doing my DV work. Just to find resources for male victims was really difficult. So, and not only that, but a lot of the shelters, too, would only take women and children. Did you find that in your research also?
I did. One of the research articles that I looked at was completed in 2009, found a total of six services available to male victims of intimate partner violence, and that was between Canada, United Kingdom, and the United States. And those are three pretty big countries, and to only have six, I find, was very minimal compared to the services available for women and children.
Yes, it's amazing. And hopefully those statistics are going to change, because we know it's reality that, yeah, men also need help with this. Now, you know, as you mentioned, you know, there's extra barriers to men reporting. And, you know, I think it's a real shame issue also on both ends. Would you agree, both of you?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I think it's, especially for men, it's hard certainly to admit to the police officer that how you got those bruises or the black eye that you have, it was a female. It's easier, actually, I would imagine, to admit that it was your male lover that did this to you. But to admit that to the officer that it's a female, or to the physician, and so you just start telling the lies to those people around you, and you also begin to believe those lies. At first, you're passive, you're non-assertive, but then as time goes on, you say, well, she didn't really mean it, or whatever. And, you know, usually, and when you compare it to male on female violence, often it doesn't result in a hospital visit or a doctor visit. And so it's easier for you to minimize it. And minimization, of course, is the way of the land. I mean, people minimize in order to stay in the relationship, where you're getting some, maybe even a third of your or a tenth of your needs met, but at least you're getting some needs met. And if you have a poor self-esteem combined with that, which you will ultimately do, because the perpetrator is consistently trying to beat you down and to control you and dominate you, and so along with that, your self-esteem is going to be battered as well. So it makes it less and less likely that you're going to speak up or assert yourself or even leave the relationship.
Right, and it seems to be a progressive process that, you know, the perpetrator works to manipulate and control so that he or she doesn't have to own their own behavior, that they can sit there and say, well, I've got control over this person, so I must be pretty important. Does that seem logical?
I know for me it does. And in fact, you know, we do need to realize that, you know, when I was talking about the statistics, being with the common couple violence being much more prevalent. I also wanted to clarify about when we look at those individuals that are capable of the most serious battering and abuse, that is usually a smaller percentage. I usually think of 5 to 10% of the population who is capable of that level of physical damage, partly because usually that involves some sort of psychiatric problem. You know, these are individuals who really are not wrapped too tight. When I think about people in my family who have suffered from domestic violence, everyone in the family knew it was going on, you know, even though she minimized it. And then ultimately it just continued to escalate to the point of where we did have a dead family member. And you know, it was, It's unfortunate that that happened that way, and everyone was very sad. But it was something that ultimately we should have seen, we should have acted, but we didn't.
And it's so difficult. I'm sorry to hear that. That's a really difficult situation to live through.
Yes, it was very bad, because my cousin was a sweetheart. Everyone loved her. And her brother, also my cousin, saw her one day, and she was all puffy. Her face was puffy, and he went home and got his gun and went and killed her husband. They had been married for about 15, 20 years when this happened. But secretly everyone was relieved, and in fact, my cousin didn't go to jail for, I think he was in jail maybe a week and a half. This was in the state of Texas, so they do things a little differently there. Because even the police knew, they had gone out on calls to the home, so everyone knew about it in the community. And it's unfortunate how the family and friends kind of unwittingly just enabled this process to occur until a family member just said, "You know what? This is crazy," and went home and got his gun.
And I think that's it's seemingly happening more and more from the reports that we're getting on the news nowadays. That's the way that it's ending, it's tragic. It is, but I think it's getting the education out there so that hopefully people feel a little more comfortable stepping forward and reporting. And I know, the victims that I've worked with, a lot of their family and friends have, were like, leave him. And it was always the intimidating factor by the perpetrator of I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to hurt you worse, or I'm going to hurt our kids worse. I mean, it was just always those threats that were keeping them locked into that relationship.
So the degree of violence you're talking about that I was referring to, these are individuals who everyone would admit have mental health problems, okay? And I'm not talking about just the self-esteem or being passive and non-assertive. I'm talking about individuals who are very dogmatic and controlling and angry and just very difficult to deal with. And of course, if they drink alcohol or use other drugs on top of that personality style, then it just really affects them in a way where they aren't even themselves. They may be during the day, nice people and can carry on a conversation. No one really knows about the monster that they become when they get drunk.
Right.
So there are individuals who they have serious mental disorders that need treatment. But that is a little separate category than what I think Kavita was talking about when she starts looking at the more widespread common couple violence that goes on at a larger level.
Exactly. Well, we're going to take a commercial break. We're going to come back with Dr. Clive Kennedy and Kavita Deo, and we're going to talk a little bit more about the domestic violence research and hopefully get everybody a little more educated about the domestic violence situation so that either you or someone that you know, if you're in that situation, you have the tools to make good decisions about what you want to do, about how to get out and get yourself safe and get your loved ones safe, okay? We're going to break for a commercial. Thank you.
The Chicago School of Professional Psychology offers numerous psychology, behavioral, and health-related science graduate degrees at 3 campuses, Los Angeles, California, including branches in Westwood and Irvine, Chicago, Illinois, and Washington, D.C., and online. The Chicago School prepares students to meet the ever-changing mental health needs of society through classroom experience and real-world training. The Chicago School Counseling Centers in Irvine and Westwood provide caring, confidential, and affordable psychological services to individuals and their families. For more information, visit thechicagoschool.edu.
And thank you to the Chicago School of Professional Psychology for supporting Psych 101. We are back with Kavita Deo and Dr. Clive Kennedy. We are speaking about domestic violence because it is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. So, Kavita, can you talk a little bit about what some really significant findings are from your research?
So, I did get a chance to do some questions at the end with my participants, and I was able to ask about their experience with reporting their intimate partner violence. And their decision to report or not to report was a little bit interesting. Some of the major responses that I got back were someone else reported, they did not report at all, issues of masculinity, they didn't want to separate the children from the father. I mean, the list goes on. There was also immigration issues, and the number one thing that kept coming up was they loved the perpetrator, so they didn't want to do anything that was going to harm the perpetrator.
Yeah, even at the cost of being on the verge of losing their lives.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and on average, about how many times does a victim leave the perpetrator before they finally go and report or they go into shelter?
I would say it's pretty high. To leave the perpetrator, a lot of the participants that I had were actually forced out of the home through social services in some way or form. It was very few women that actually made the choice to leave themselves.
Wow. That's, and you realize, I mean, with social services, they're so overloaded with cases right now that, you know, waiting for somebody to come and rescue you out of that situation is, you know, wow.
And sometimes it's children's services who have,
right.
You know, come to take a stand on that, because they, if you as a parent is allowing your child to observe or witness arguing, fighting, conflict between you and your partner, then you are failing to protect your child. And so Department of Child and Family Services looks at this very seriously. And so they look at it as a choice. And in some respects, it is a choice. And so if you're choosing to subject yourself to violence, that's one thing. But if you're going to subject children who really have no say-so in this whole process, then you really run the risk of losing your child.
Yeah, not only that, but the research that I've seen on children who are involved in a DV household, there is some form of brain damage because they can't process out exactly what's happening, because here is their parents right in front of them who they love, and they're witnessing the yelling, the screaming, the hitting, and everything else that goes along with it, and it overwhelms their nervous system. Have you seen research on that also?
Yes, it certainly impacts the neurological development, Kavita can talk about that. And I'm glad you brought it up from the neurological standpoint, because, you know, of course, we always knew with child abuse that there were children who suffered damage to their head and the rest of their body. And so as well as with spousal abuse as well. But just witnessing, just even lying in bed at night trying to go to sleep, when children observe, when they hear, and I'm not just talking about watching, but I'm talking about listening to your parents fight through the walls and hearing the demeaning, and especially if one of them cries out or is sobbing. These are things that will really affect you, not only emotionally, but as you say, neurologically, and it can contribute to depression and anxiety disorders later on down the road as you get older.
Right, and they're almost in a hyper alert state because they're waiting for something to happen, you know, and they're just, you know, too much adrenaline for too small of a body can be damaging.
Yes, very much so. So these physiological, brain chemical changes that are going on, as you mentioned, is really impacting the child and creating other kinds of disorders, which may be attention deficit disorder, other kinds of learning problems for the child at school. So again, I think that when we talk about the county services, whether it's social service or child protective services, that is often what is the catalyst to get individuals to seek help.
Right. And Kavita, can you also add to that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with what both you and Dr. Kennedy are saying. It does play a role with the brain as a whole, and that can ultimately impact the sensory input and motor output of children. So then we see behavioral and emotional issues in these children at school. So they might come off as being ADHD or oppositional defiant, whereas the actual issue lies with being trauma, witnessing trauma or experiencing trauma themselves. It also, like you were talking about, leaves individuals feeling in a state of hypervigilance where that is their homeostasis. So they are constantly on alert and they're living in that state, which can be anxiety provoking. And eventually some of these issues that are impacted by the brain can lead to aggression or antisocial traits when these individuals reach either adolescence or adulthood.
Yeah, and I would imagine also that it impacts how much that child can learn because they are taking their home life with them to school.
Absolutely. Post-traumatic stress disorder with the flashbacks of if a child is constantly having flashbacks or worried about mom being harmed while they're at school, like these issues come out in the classroom. And again, the diagnoses may vary as the child is not paying attention or is not learning or up to par with the grade level because they can't function at school.
And you wonder now with more diagnosing of ADHD and ADD by schools, if this has a huge component of what is going on at home and they just cannot verbalize it.
I absolutely agree that they can't. The children are not equipped to verbalize or express certain emotions and feelings that they may have from witnessing something traumatic, such as domestic violence.
Yeah, and sometimes
they're told not to talk about this in school. And that they're warned and they're threatened. And so you do have child victims who are not going to speak about this trauma. And it's not as easy with physical abuse where you actually can see those wounds. We're talking about wounds really that are invisible to the teachers. And so unfortunately it can go on for years. And I just wanted people to have that image of, you know, crying yourself to sleep at night if you get any sleep because you hear your mom and your dad fighting over and over again.
Yeah, or one of the parents is also abusing the children. That's an issue on top of an issue there, and it's very complicated with domestic violence households. It can be multi-layered and very confusing to have to unwind through. Now, the children that I worked with when I was doing my practicum last year, a lot of them were boys and diagnosed with ADHD, you know, before even doctors, you know, were properly diagnosed. But they were kindergarten through third grade. And some of them I could tell that, you know, just to get to that trauma narrative as to what exactly was going on in the family system at home was pretty tricky. I mean, we did some play therapy and, you know, sometimes they would just surface naturally and they would blurt something out. But it's very difficult to get to that root with a lot of these little ones. So as clinicians, anybody that is in this situation, and there's a lot of that layering, and as you stated, Dr. Kennedy, they are told not to tell. They are threatened not to tell with various means. What?
And, you know, I was referring at that time to children, but, you know, this is true for the person who is the survivor of domestic violence as well. You will have them sworn to secrecy. And so, of course, this just complicates their own feelings of shame and embarrassment of going to, you know, a parent or a family member. And so they just keep it to themselves. And again, if it's a male who is actually on the receiving end of that kind of brutality, believe me, especially in some cultures, you're going to have a lot of ridicule and scorn by family members who witness or are aware of how your partner abuses you.
Yeah, I mean, downright, probably in every culture on this planet, it's emasculating for many men. It's just on a basic surface level. That would, I imagine, would be one of the biggest barriers to get through. Am I right?
Yeah. It's very hard. It's a sense of shame. But, you know, in our culture, there's so many shame-based types of abuse that goes on, whether it's sexual abuse or other physical abuse. But domestic violence is just one of those right there. Just even being afraid to tell anyone that your parent passes out from getting drunk, you know, a couple of times a week. I've seen children suffer in silence just about that as well. So a lot of problems within the family, children are the first to suffer. And it's incumbent upon us as health professionals to take the necessary steps to get involved and to rescue the victim who is in that situation and unable to remove themselves.
So how would anybody that is involved with the victim start approaching him or her and saying, hey, I'm really concerned about what you're going through and you're not talking about it, but I can tell that something is wrong? How would you suggest that somebody can go up to a loved one and start approaching that really difficult subject?
I think part of it is just being genuine and being a constant support, because it's not going to happen with one discussion, because it might feel like you're attacking their loved one and their situation. So I think it's just going to be constant support and information that you can provide for them.
So try to keep it as neutral as possible, but yet caring, right? So don't sit there and add fuel to the fire and, you know,
right,
get totally worked up about it and stuff. Because I know the victims that I've worked with, they had other family members in their faces going, you need to leave this person, you need to leave, you know, and they would get all excited. So there's almost another addition of abuse, even though it's within a caring context. It's in your face and you need to do this and you need to do that, and the perpetrator is doing the same thing to that person.
Right.
And you know, it is hard for the family member. You know, as again, having gone through it myself, I know it becomes very difficult for you to really to inject yourself into someone else's business. You know, and you know that they're being abused, but when you bring it up, you're actually told to mind your own business, stay out of it. And you know, we do these presentations, these panels. We do these panels for on university campuses, where we have the men and women in university campuses talk about their relationships and how they deal with each other, and we ask them, how would you handle a situation where your friend tells you to just, you know, stay out of my business, and she's sitting over there with, you know, bruises on her face and a black eye, and I was amazed at how many people just enable that process to occur because of the sake of the friendship. And that's it's a very difficult decision, but really you have to be willing to do what you think is the right thing. And if you see your friend going through this on a regular basis, you pretty much have to put the relationship on the line and be willing to call social services or do whatever you need to do to protect your friend, even though it may cause you to lose a friend. But you'd rather lose a friend because of their choice rather than lose a friend because they died.
That's a very good point, Dr. Kennedy. Kavita, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I absolutely agree with Dr. Kennedy.
So, what one thing could you recommend? And Dr. Kennedy said, you know, at a certain point, you call social services versus just letting them keep on going with the process. Is there anything that at the beginning of the abuse, when you start seeing the signs, that you can do that hopefully the victim will listen to? Is there any recommendations you can make?
I think as a society in whole, it should be awareness about what intimate partner violence looks like, including the lesser forms that we sometimes forget about besides the physical, is the verbal and emotional and the sexual and neglect. And if we, as a society, can build awareness around those things as well, you know, red flags, what red flags may look like in a relationship, and that slow trickling into severe domestic violence or intimate partner violence, maybe there could be a process where mental health services or social services or DCFS can intervene before it becomes severe.
So it's just getting that information out there before it's too late, correct?
And I think we do need to do a better job about having posters on the subway, on the buses, on the billboards, where they just take a common picture of a couple arguing, and communicate how damaging that is, not only to the children, but to the relationship and the household. Because ultimately, that could escalate into a confrontation that ends up with someone going to the hospital or worse.
Right, exactly. Now, I saw at a certain point that there were more public service announcements and billboards and such happening with that. It seemed that there was a phase that was happening there, and I was applauding whoever was putting out that information, because that's the way that we start changing lives, is just hitting up people on a subconscious level. Like, they look at the billboard and go, oh, that's me, or oh, that's my friend or my family member or whatever. And the light bulb starts going on, like, that doesn't look right. Or it triggers something. It triggers a discomfort to start getting into action and doing something about it versus just being afraid in the shadows.
Yeah, you're very right. That's true. And you're right. I think it seems as though we went through a period where there was a decline in seeing the billboards and the messages. But we do need to continue to be there and just put that on everyone's mind that domestic violence does not always involve physical violence. It can be having a friend who's not allowed to buy anything because their partner controls the checkbook or controls other things in the household, because it's that insidious power and control and domination that actually becomes the silent killer.
And where do you think that ultimate control comes from, that the perpetrator wants to, you know, take over somebody's life ultimately?
I think part of it's insecurities on the perpetrators and their fear of maybe being alone. Their low self-esteem or self-worth may come into play too.
And also, I would guess, too, that a lot of the perpetrators were also abused as children, and they never worked through those issues. Is that correct?
It can be for some, yeah.
And I think that for many people, you know, being exposed to domestic violence, I often think of it as kind of like vampires. I mean, once you have had that experience, once you've been bitten, then you do run the risk of perpetuating that the next generation. So, you know, I've seen situations where I'm working with a parent couple to really help them learn better ways of handling their anger and to separate that away from their children, and find out that the daughter is in a relationship herself at 14, dating someone who is abusing her. And so unwittingly, that can just be passed on generation to generation. And we don't really realize that you're perpetuating the very trauma that's going up, that you have lived in at your age.
So in order to stop that multi-generational transmission of being either an abuser or a victim, what would be a good path to follow to get off of that, to say, I've had enough, I want to stop this, I don't want to have my child also abused, even if I was abused, or, you know, I mean, what would be a good start to get onto that healthier path?
I definitely think as a society, we are responsible to identify and make the awareness and the billboards and things like that that we talked about earlier. It's the education aspect of how do we end some of these things. And like you said, it happened for a period of time and then it stopped. So it's just, if it can continue to grow and as a society address certain things, such as gender roles and things like that, we could help start to reduce some of these issues.
Yeah, and maybe to find some way as a society or clinicians to be able to package up this information where it's a little more comfortable for the victim to be able to receive it, where they don't feel like they're being bombarded with that energy. I've worked at DV fairs, and some of the women, I could tell when they were coming up to the tables, were a little shy, but something was going on, and they would just pick up the information almost like secretively and just walk away, And I've seen some of them almost like, you know, kind of look around to make sure that nobody was looking and then take off. So it was, you could tell that there was a lot of fear and shame and just even approaching the subject, you know, even though we weren't in people's faces about it, we were just sitting at the table waiting for people to approach us about it. There's that stigma about being seen and possibly identified as a victim. So,
and I think also including it in the doctor's offices, having posters up and brochures, as you mentioned, but also in churches, because, you know, unwittingly, you know, one of Kavita's classmates, her dissertation was on the kind of support that, in this particular case, it was on a Hispanic population, and in those particular churches, as in many other cultures, the family is urged to stay together at all costs. And one of the findings that she had was that of the females that she interviewed, those females who had actually experienced domestic violence felt the least amount of support from the pastor in those congregations. It was only those individuals who had no experience with domestic violence who would say, well, the pastor can help me, or the church is going to be a helpful resource for me, you know, if I go through domestic violence. But those people who really knew, who had experienced domestic violence, knew that the pastors in most churches were not supportive of helping her. In this case, they were women, helping her to leave her perpetrator or to get help.
That's a great point. That is a great point. And I guess it's educating also the church staff on those situations. So there's a lot of education that needs to be gone on across the board from what it sounds like.
Definitely.
And that's going to take time and effort and funding. So I hope it happens. This is just one, I feel this is one of those near preventable tragedies that can be prevented. I really believe in the prevention model for domestic violence. Get the information out there. Let's start talking about it as a society, because it goes on globally and people are just so unwilling to talk about it, and it needs to be brought to light. And we need to become more comfortable talking about this, because it is so important. It can affect people from their childhood all the way through their total adulthood if it's left unresolved. So I think this is huge. Now, Dr. Kennedy, can you tell us a little bit about the public education forum that you were talking about at the beginning of the show up in Westwood?
Yes, that's going to be actually taking place on May 16th, I believe, Friday from 1 to 3 at the Westwood office. I don't have the Westwood campus. I don't have that direct address, but if you can call the main office, 213-615-7200, they can give you the details about that. But I do know it's going to be taking place on Friday, the 16th of May. There will be a second panel of psychology professors that are going to be at another another panel on June 13th, and that is specifically on the anniversary of the O.J. Simpson killing, the O.J. Simpson case. And so they'll be actually deconstructing issues surrounding the trial and the incident. And so we're going to be looking at it from a psychological point of view, emotional point of view, as well as a forensic point of view.
That's fascinating. I'm sure that's going to be information-packed. And there's just so many more details that are coming out about that case now.
Yep. So we thought it would be an opportunity for us now that things have kind of cooled off, because, you know, frankly, there was a lot of strong feelings throughout the community about that particular case and the subsequent trial. So we thought that this would be an ample time for us to come back and revisit some of those issues, that many of which are still alive and with us today.
Yeah, sadly enough. So is there anything else that you would both like to say as we're wrapping up? We've got about a minute and 30 seconds left.
Well, we just need to provide more information, more education, but also services. And services need to be woven together. I think one of the reasons why people are reluctant to come forward is because they don't want to just put their partner in jail. But seeking services is a very important first step, and there are times when someone does need to go to jail, you know, and then that may be the only wake-up call that actually saves a person's life.
Right. Thank you, Dr. Kennedy. And Kavita?
That anyone can fall victim to intimate partner violence, regardless of gender or sexuality, and it's good to have awareness. Even if it's through a billboard or a brochure that you may pick up, and passing it along to other friends and family members.
Yeah, that's excellent. Kavita Deo and Dr. Clive Kennedy, thank you so much for being back on the show and talking about domestic violence. I really appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Take care.
Appreciate your listeners for taking in. Okay.
Thank you. And If you would like to listen to this broadcast again, it is on iTunes Store on Psych 1-on-1, PSYCH 1-on-1. In the podcast, we are also on Stitcher, and this is skidrowstudios.com. If you would like to contact me at all, my email is jgoode8@verizon.net, and my phone number is 562-234-4650. Thank you so much for listening. I know this was probably a tough subject, but it is really worthwhile getting this information and saving your life or saving somebody else's life that you know. I really appreciate you being here. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. This is Julianne Good for Psych 101. Thank you.